welcome to the Creative Pen Podcast. I'm Joanna Penn, thriller author and professional speaker, bringing you interviews, inspiration and information on writing, publishing options and marketing ideas for your book. You can find the episode show notes, your free Author 2.0 blueprint and lots more information at thecreativepen.com. And that's pen with a double N. And here's the show. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn, and this is episode number 217 of the podcast, and it's 12th of May as I record this early for the show. I'm off to Bristol for Crime Fest this weekend, so I wanted to get it all sorted out before I go, because 4 days talking murder and mayhem and possibly drinking some gin and I'm speaking every day I'm down there will probably leave me a little bit crazy. So I thought I'd do this while I still have some energy. So today I have a fantastic interview with Jen Blood, a thriller author, but also my editor. And I get so many people asking questions about editing, so I thought we would go through them all, and also you'll get a fascinating glimpse into both of our creative processes towards the end, which I found really interesting. It's always so weird to talk to people about how they actually get their writing done. So I think you'll enjoy that part of the conversation. In terms of publishing stuff, the latest author earnings report is out, and you can find that at authorearnings.com. And I'm looking at the May 2015 version, and it's really about the impact of renewed agency pricing, which means that the publisher, traditional publishers, are back to setting their own prices on Amazon, resulting in higher ebook prices overall and a diminishing market share in the bestseller list for traditional published authors. And I've certainly seen in some of the forums I'm in on Facebook that authors are like, seriously, how come my book price is that high? But of course, you don't have a choice if you are traditionally published on your book price. And actually, that's one of the things that Hugh Howey says on the author earnings report, is authors and agents should consider trying to set price boundaries within contracts to avoid essentially not selling any books because of high pricing. This has resulted in the indie author share of ebook unit sales, which has now overtaken traditionally published books at 37%. So really fascinating. And I mean, I certainly think that as a reader, and I don't think it's about, in quotation marks, cheap books, I think it's about a fair price. And I think that $4.99 is a fair price US for a full-length novel. I think $2.99 US is a fair price for a novella. And, you know, I don't want to pay $15 or whatever for a new book as a reader. And if you talk to most readers, they, you know, big readers, like, you know, I read 3 to 5 books a week, and I've already read 3 this week, and it's only Tuesday. My husband's away, so I've been reading an awful lot, mainly thrillers and disturbing things, but it's been super. But you know, I'm not going to pay that much per book when I'm reading one almost every day. I am doing some work, by the way, just so you know. That's my evenings if I'm reading. Anyway, just ignore the talk of ebook sales flattening or decreasing as well. Remember, over 30% of ebooks now have no ISBN. Certainly none of mine do. And the traditional publishing surveys ignore any books without ISBN, so they ignore most indie books. Also, these surveys are still only really about the US and occasionally about the UK. And as sales begin to grow in other countries, these things will shift. And on that topic, I want to point you at an article out this week from Peter Diamandis, who wrote the fantastic books Abundant and Bold. And you should definitely read if you want to know what's coming and how exciting the next phase of tech will be. It's about predicting the next 10 years, so the world in 2025. And he talks a bit about one of the things, he talks about a number of things. And he's one of the guys involved with, you know, the space stuff and the X Prize and Singularity University. And he's just an amazing guy. He talks a bit about 8 billion hyperconnected people. And I mean, you guys know that I've talked about people buying on cell phones and how exciting that is. But he goes further, talks about projects like Facebook's internet.org, SpaceX, Google's Project Loon, Qualcomm and Virgin's OneWeb, with basically the aim is to bring, you know, Wi-Fi, not Wi-Fi, you know, like wireless connectivity to every human on Earth within the next 10 years, which will add 5 billion new consumers to the economy. And they certainly will not be through laptops, desktops. They certainly won't be building bookstores. You know, this will be cell phones and whatever the next technology is. So that's really exciting to me. That's where I see our frontier being. Our frontiers are global, and our frontiers are telling, you know, education, inspiration, and entertainment in new ways. So whether that's virtual reality or gaming or whatever the next tech is, we will still, the content that we create, the things that we make that are new in the world will still be needed. Whatever the change in technology, it won't change, you know, sort of fundamental human requirements. And in fact, people like, you know, curators and people who can sift through all this stuff will be needed more and more. So anyway, I think we're living in really exciting times. And I know that's probably my opinion, but I'm a change junkie. And I think, you know, the change is only speeding up. So I hope to continue bringing you the bleeding edge as such over time. Right, sort of more immediate stuff as opposed to the future, immediate things and time critical things. I am doing a webinar with Joseph Michael, the Scrivener Coach, on Thursday, May 21st at 3 p.m. US Eastern, 8 p.m. London. And we'll be sharing some new things I'm doing on Scrivener for the latest novel and also for the nonfiction project. Plus, you'll get loads of tips from Joe, who every time I see Joe do his thing, I learn new things about Scrivener. It's very powerful software. I mean, you don't need to use all the functionality, but when you, it's like you learn one thing every time. So I'm really looking forward to that. If you sign up, you'll be able to get the replay. So even if you can't attend live, sign on up and you'll get the replay, which will be 90 minutes. It will be 60-minute presentation. And then we'll have 30 minutes Q&A, live Q&A. So come on and ask me questions. I would really like that. You can register at thecreativepen.com/Scrivener or webinar. Or one word. So thecreativepen.com/Scrivener webinar, or check the show notes for this podcast, which you can always find at thecreativepen.com/podcasts, where there is a whole list of every single episode. Also, time critical, you know, ish, I say ish, I would really, really like you guys to fill in my new survey, which is my, what I'm aiming to do is essentially improve what I deliver to you for the rest of the year, you know, for the next year pretty much. As I come into year six this December, I want to make sure that I'm giving you guys what you need. Actually, I think I am in year six and I'm moving into year seven. I started in December 2008. Gosh, that's scary. Oh, weird. Anyway, you can complete the survey at thecreativepen.com/2015survey. So the numbers 2015 survey, again, all one word, thecreativepen.com/2015survey. And I'd love you to do that within the month of May 2015. Or if you do it before May 21st, you'll be in to win a $50 US Amazon voucher. But basically, you're doing it out of the kindness of your heart and because you want to tell me what you need to know so I can schedule the right people on the podcast, and I'd love to hear from you. So that's the free webinar for the Scrivener webinar and the 2015 survey. Right, little update, short. I did a full-day workshop last weekend in London on how to make a living with your writing, and it's essentially how I make a full-time income based on writing books and blogs and how I have my multiple streams of income. And I'm really happy with how it went. And you know, I know I've kind of nailed it when I've anticipated every single question and made sure I've covered that material. So I definitely am turning that into an ebook, and I actually have a cover done. I just need to finish the damn book. And also I'm going to do a course on Udemy with the same material. Again, I just need to make the time to do that and it will happen. I'm still in delirium. No, I'm not. I'm still in deviance. The third in the London Psychic series. And that's at 43,000 words, something like that. And I really want to finish the first draft by the time I go on holiday at the end of the month. We're cycling in Croatia, which will be very cool. Cycling from Split to Dubrovnik. So that will be fun. Although the last time I went on a cycling holiday, I have a big scar on my knee from where I came off the bike on a pothole in India. But, you know, it, as my friend Alistair Humphrey says, it's type 2 fun, which is at the time might not be so fun. But afterwards, you say it was really, really fun, which is a bit like writing a book sometimes. Okay, we also now, we kind of have a new regular segment on the show, which is, what are you doing while listening to the podcast? And we've had a couple of tweets after last time when I shared a few people's stuff. Anthony St. Clair says he's at the grocery store. Marie Mazigan says, I usually listen to your podcast while cleaning the church next door. Marie, you know, I just feel like I'm not doing my, you know, enough when you're cleaning the church. That's just superstar. And Ellen Bard said she listened to the last podcast half in Thailand and half in Saudi Arabia, which is pretty cool. So whilst traveling. So I would love to hear from you. Please tweet me at the creative pen with a double N, or email me joanna@thecreativepen.com, and I'll give you a shout out because you know, either where you are in the world or what you're doing while listening to the show. I do talk to people about this in terms of book marketing. So often what you assume about your life is normal is really interesting to other people. So yeah, just try and share that stuff more. Okay. This podcast episode is sponsored by 99designs, and we all know that a fantastic book cover will help you stand out in the market, and it's probably the number one marketing material that you need, in that people do judge a book by its cover. And you can also get logos, business cards, website design, packaging, bookmarks, merchandise and other things from 99designs. Now, you know, I do see a lot of indie authors still with terrible book covers, and I wonder if people can either not tell that they're terrible or they just don't want to spend the money. But if you are, you know, if your book cover is dated, or if it's just not good enough, or it gives the wrong branding message, which I've certainly got wrong in the past, I've redone almost all of my covers, I believe. But anyway, you can use 99designs.com to get a new book cover, and essentially there's no risk, because what happens is you put up your project and then a whole load of designers give you ideas, and you can shortlist the process, and then you can get your friends on Twitter or your Facebook page or just your mates to vote on the things that they like. And that's always interesting, because the things that you think are great often are not what other people like, so that's fascinating. You can also use 99designs for custom illustration, as I did for The Key to the Gates of Hell, which features on the cover and inside the print book as a motif, which I like inside print books. It looks really stunning. So with 99designs, you can get a power pack upgrade, which gives your project more chance of getting noticed, with bold headers, highlighted background and featured listing, by going to 99designs.com/Joanna. That's J-O-A-N-N-A, 99designs.com/Joanna. And that will give you a power pack upgrade, which is worth $99. So this corporate sponsorship pays for my hosting, but my time in producing this show is primarily sponsored by you guys. So a big thank you to all the people supporting on Patreon. Thanks in particular to new supporters, Honoré Corda and Laura N. And yeah, thank you to everyone on Patreon. And if you would like to support on Patreon, you can support me with a few dollars, or even just $1 per show, to a maximum of 2 shows a month, so less than a coffee a month. And you can support the show at patreon.com, patreon.com/thecreativepen. Or, of course, you can buy my books. Thank you so much. Let's get on with the interview. Hi everyone, I'm Joanna Penn from thecreativepen.com, and today I'm here with Jen Blood. Hi Jen!
Hi, Gloria.
It's great to have you on the show. Just a little introduction. So Jen is the best-selling author of the Erin Solomon thriller series, which is super, as well as being a fantastic editor at Addian Editing. And Jen has been my own fiction editor for over a year now, I think, and, you know, really improved my writing. So Jen, I'm so pleased to have you on the show. It's super.
Yeah, I'm very excited to be here. This is very cool.
It is. And of course, you normally get to edit me and we don't talk about editing. So today we're going to get into it. So first of all, tell us a bit more about you and your writing background.
Sure. Well, basically, I started writing when I was, I started professionally writing about 15 years ago. And I have an undergraduate and a graduate degree in creative writing. I've worked basically every job you can comprehend in writing. So I've been a reporter, and I've been a proofreader and an editor for a newspaper, and I've ghost written and just tons of weird and good and not so good jobs having to do with writing. And so I've been doing it for a while, and First, self-published my Erin Solomon series in 2012, and so I have five of those out now, and I first opened the doors officially to my editing business in 2014.
Yeah, wow, it's a lot of progression and a lot of writing. But today we're going to come back to the Erin Solomon stuff. But let's, you know, just the basics. Because when people say, oh, you know, what about an editor can actually mean a lot of different things, can't it? So can you explain, I guess, the different types of editing that an author might encounter?
Sure. And it does. It definitely varies depending on where you are as a writer, and kind of what your goals as a writer may be. I have some writers who are very focused on getting books out. And so with those, then my job is a little bit more intensive. Then I have others who are focused on traditional publishing, and they're very keen on basically really honing every sentence, and so it varies depending on what your goals are. But essentially, the different types of editing are there's beta reading, there is content editing, there's copy or line editing, and there's proofreading. So those are the general types that are out there.
And I think like you said, it differs depending on where you are as an author. Mm-hmm. And would you say that people probably need to spend the most on editing for their first book, and therefore it becomes like a big stumbling block at the beginning?
Yeah, that definitely is the catch-22, is that it's before you've made much money or any money from your writing, that's when you need to shell out the most. And yeah, and I really do. I think it's a very worthwhile investment to take that extra time and work with someone who really knows what they're doing, that you trust, so that the two of you can sort of work together to achieve this the vision that you have of what you want your novel to be.
And so, because I mean, a lot of people will say, well, I get emails and people say, oh, well, I want an editor, but I only want to spend a little bit. Do you think you get what you pay for in terms of editing?
You know, I really do. I think that you do. I mean, there are good editors that are out there who are just starting out maybe, and so their rates aren't quite as high. But the reality is that, if you're looking for someone that not only knows how to edit well and can work with you throughout, you know, from the developmental edit through to the point where you're publishing, but also knows a little bit about the genre and the market, and there's a lot to know as an editor. And so I think that if you're gonna get that level of experience, then you are going to need to pay a little bit more. So it doesn't necessarily, I mean, it doesn't need to, you don't need to go into debt for the rest of your life. It's something that I think people, you may have to pinch pennies for a little while, but I think ultimately it's usually worth it for people.
Mm. And I mean, I try and frame it as an investment, you know, as in if you're expecting to make money from your book as a business, mm-hmm. then you need to invest money in that book to make it the best product it can be. Would you agree with that?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. And I think, and I mean, I think I actually have several clients who have come to me after they've spent a little bit less on editing and actually had the novel published and have gotten feedback that it's not great editing and stuff. And so they come to me after the fact. And so, you know, that's an example of sort of paying through the nose by not just, you know, biting the bullet and paying up front for what you need to make it happen.
Yeah, and another question I get surprisingly often, maybe you hear this too, is I'm worried about sending a book to an editor because they might steal my ideas. What's your answer to that?
I mean, I think that especially for new writers, that's a big concern. That's something that they worry about a lot. And the reality is that I think it's the same with pretty much any, if you talk to veteran authors and you talk about the idea of worrying about someone stealing your idea and stuff, generally what they tell you is that it's not the idea that you need to worry about, because everybody has ideas and whatever. It's your unique take on that idea. It's the way that you write it. It's all of that that makes it your novel. And so in that sense, it's unlikely that somebody is going to outright steal something like that. If you are concerned, I actually do have in part of my contract that, you know, if this is solely your property. And so I think that you can certainly incorporate that or talk to your editor about it if it's something that you're concerned about.
Mm. Yeah, that's interesting because you do a contract, and I've worked with a lot of editors over the years now, and not all of them do have a contract. Sometimes it's more like more of a handshake agreement, and you know, you could pay a deposit, but you know, that there wasn't necessarily a contract. So what do you feel is the editor's job, and what do you put in that contract so people can kind of assess their options?
Well, basically, I think that the editor's job, again, it really depends on the client in terms of what they're looking for. But for me personally, I view my job as doing everything that I can to deliver a professionally put together novel that is at the highest caliber possible. And so that means that obviously in terms of like grammar and punctuation and all of those things, that it's free of that stuff. But beyond that, it's making sure that the characters ring true and the pacing is consistent throughout and will keep the reader coming back. And that it's a high level of prose, that all of that stuff. And so in terms of what's in the contract, that for me really was, it's interesting, like the evolution of the contract, because I'd been sort of running a business and hadn't been really focused on it for a while. It had been running on the sidelines, but I'd been doing other things and you know, did editing, but I also did some graphic design, and you could hire me for all these different things. When I made the decision that I was exclusively going to be an editor, then it was almost a psychological thing for me to just be like, all right, we're going to do this. We're going to do it right. I'm going to get the contract. I'm going to, get the logo and do all of these things and make this a business venture. And so, so it was kind of along those lines. And basically, in terms of the contract, it really is just letting the client know what they can expect from me, letting them know that their work is safe with me, letting them, you know, talking about payment schedule and all of those things so that everything is sort of defined on the page as we start.
Mm. And another important thing there is date, I think.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so the date that the client has to deliver the book, as in you've agreed what date, mm-hmm. and then the date that you will give it back again. And, I mean, I know this is a massive deal because, you know, from your point of view, people have to book editors, don't they, in mm-hmm. advance. You cannot just go, oh, my book's ready to edit today, I'm just going to send it to somebody. How long should people be thinking in advance?
At this point, well, actually, I'm not taking new clients right now, but
in general, for any editor.
In general, though, when I am, then it's usually you should be thinking at least 2 months in advance. That's yeah, it's a minimum of 2 months in advance. You should check in and make sure that there's space and connect with the editor, particularly if it's someone that you haven't worked with before. Mm-hmm. Then 2 to 3 months is usually safe to sort of get the ball rolling.
Yeah, and then obviously you can kind of finesse that timing as you get closer to it. And then obviously you say what date you're going to give it back again, which I think all editors would do, right? Would say, yeah, it'll take... Well, how long will it take usually to do a full edit?
Yeah, and typically that's... it's been a learning process for me, so depending on how extensive the edits are and how long the book is, then anywhere from 2 to 4 weeks, basically, is what you're looking at.
Mm, absolutely. No, that's super. And then I think about dating as dating. I think about editing.
Yes indeed. A whole other interview.
Yes, no, I think about editing as a bit like dating in mm-hmm. that you don't, because people say, well, how do I find an editor? And it's like, well, you don't just look on the internet, find the first one and book them. That's not really how you do it. There is a bit of kind of looking around before you find someone who might match. So how do you recommend people find the best editor for them?
You know, word of mouth, I think, is huge. If you are reading a novel, particularly by independent authors, if you're reading a novel and you find that you really like it, it's, you know, really, it's error-free and the pacing is good and character and all of these things, then independent authors are usually pretty approachable. So just, you know, send them a line and say, hey, you know, who edited your work? That, I think, is one of the best ways to find out. And from there, you know, check out the website or send a query to the editor, just finding out what their availability is and what their specialty is. Most editors have a particular genre that they work with. And in my opinion, it is very important to work with an editor who really knows your genre. It doesn't make sense. There's so many subtle differences between the genres that is really good to work with someone who's very enthusiastic about the genre you work in. Mm. So, I think that those are the major things. And then, yeah, it really is. It's a word of mouth and kind of reading the different blogs that are online and reading interviews with different editors and stuff like that. And then ultimately, the biggest test is going to be corresponding with the editor and how they respond to you and what that kind of interaction is like and that kind of thing.
Mm. And yeah, it's funny you say that. You know, I found you after my previous editor resigned because of a particularly gory scene in one of my books. And you were like, yeah, this is great. And, you know, that's really important, isn't it? To find somebody, mm-hmm. you know, and you're a thriller writer, so that's why right. we resonate. But just back on finding the right editor, do editors still do that kind of test edit on a chapter? Is that something that people can do?
Yeah, definitely. I think most editors at this point do offer some kind of sample edit. They may charge for it, they may not. Don't be turned off in either case. If it's free, that's great. If it's not, then, you know, it's usually, you certainly shouldn't pay a lot for a sample edit. It's usually $50 is maximum for a sample edit usually, and I think that's pretty high. Mine are $25. So, yeah, and that is, I think, a really important thing to have. It just, it gives you a really good idea of how the editor works, what you can expect from them in terms of feedback, and whether or not they kind of get what you're going for with your books.
Yeah, which is interesting. And then how is the best sort of way to prepare your manuscript before you submit to an editor? So how can authors edit themselves before going to a professional?
I think the most important thing, especially with newer writers, is beta readers. That's a really important thing. I think a lot of times when I'm working with newer writers, then I'll actually suggest, you know, doing, I'll either suggest doing a professional beta read, or I'll suggest that they work with some beta readers on their own first. And that to me is, it's just invaluable to be able to get somebody else's perspective on how a novel is working. And so beta readers, beyond that, it's just, you know, basically paying attention to punctuation and grammar and that stuff to some extent. And the other thing that I find particularly with newer writers is that a lot of times they'll have like a plot and subplots, and some of the subplots don't necessarily resolve themselves in the novel in an early draft. So just as you're going through, sort of write down what the plot and the subplots are, and then make sure that you have some kind of resolution for each of those. Mm. And if you can do that, then that means that I think you're in pretty good shape to start working with an editor.
Yeah, I must say, I find your story comments really, really helpful. And I mean, sometimes, you know, you do your own edit and you can't see the problems, or you know there's a problem but you just don't know how to fix it, and you know, that's when having a professional like yourself to kind of look at it and go, well, look, you didn't resolve this, or you need a scene here that will wind up that thing. You know, you've suggested several things like that for me which have helped kind of finish internal circles, you know, almost, which are just, it's very hard to see yourself.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and I think the problem when you're first starting out as a writer is you're scared of editing because of the kind of the psychological pain. So I guess my question there is, how does someone know if it's a good edit? As in, what you don't want is a pat on the back. Oh, that was great. No issues at all. And you probably also don't want change every single line. So how do people kind of know what a good edit is if they haven't had one before?
That's a good question. I think that basically, as you said, you know, you definitely don't want a pat on the back. If you're paying good money, then, you know, what's the point? Basically, it's a matter, I think it's, at least with my own edits, it's a matter of, and I think with the editors that I've worked with on my own writing, it's a matter of the way that the editor approaches it. There should be some amount of positivity from the start. I think that the editor should be enthusiastic in some way with the story that you're telling, and should be able to point out, you know, you're doing this right, you're doing this right, you're almost there with this, and if you do X, Y, and Z, then you're going to be there. And I think sort of couching it in those terms, and then beyond that, sort of recognizing, particularly if you're a newer writer, that there is going to be some red on the page, and sometimes it's going to be fairly extensive. So, but the editor should be able to put a positive spin on it. You shouldn't feel like you're being beaten up when you're being edited.
Yeah, I think it at the beginning it is really difficult. and you just kind of have to get used to it and realize you're paying for someone to help you make the book a better product.
Yes.
And that to me is kind of the essence of an editor. And mm-hmm. I just don't think you can do it for yourself. You know, it's very, I mean, we're going to come back to you and how you do it in a minute, but, can we just, you said there that you will, sometimes recommend people go and get another beta read. When will you actually reject a client, as in what are the kind of characteristics of this ain't good enough yet?
Mm-hmm. Basically, it's at this point, I have a questionnaire that I give out to a potential client. I ask for a sample chapter, the first chapter, and then I ask for about 25 to 35 pages in the middle of the novel. If in reading that, what I'm finding is that there's a lot of head hopping, which is the thing where you're switching perspectives sort of willy-nilly between the different characters. A lot of sort of, it's the whole telling rather than showing, if I'm seeing a lot of that on the page. And then in terms of pacing and that kind of thing, if I see a lot of that, and on the questionnaire the author is having a hard time defining what the plot is, one of the questions I ask is what the catalyst for that everything sets everything in motion for the story. If they can't define what that is and what the character's central conflict is, then that usually is a good indication that you're not quite ready for an editor, and it's a good idea to get beta readers just to start things out.
Mm. That's really interesting. I must say, I think the point of view, which you said as perspective there, that is kind of one of those penny dropping moments that happens, I think, when you start to learn to write a novel. That's kind of one of the big things, isn't it?
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it is. It's very hard. It's so much easier to tell a story if you can just tell it from everybody's perspective. And so, to sort of discipline yourself and say, oh, you know what, we can't just switch from this person to that person without preparing the reader in some way, or, you know, making some kind of clean division or whatever. So, it is. It's just one of those things that with time it becomes natural, but early on it's a hard thing to grasp.
It's hard. And then what I also think is that, you know, other things come up every time. So like on my last book, I was using the comma and ing, you know, something ing mm-hmm. a lot, and you were like, you should, you know, you're using this too much. Can you explain that in proper English, what I was getting wrong? Yeah.
I can try. I think that's another one that's very common, is looking at the rhythm of a paragraph. If you're using the same kind of, sentences over and over again, like one of the obvious is if every sentence begins with he did this or he did that, or as you get more advanced, then you know to avoid that, but then you can fall into the trap of, as you said, the ing trap, which is he went to the bank flying along the way, and, you know, something like that, where you start that and that's fine, but then if you have another sentence that follows that same pattern, then it just gets tiresome for the reader. So it's kind of looking at that kind of thing.
Yeah, and you just don't see it on your own. And it's funny you say that about the so-and-so did this, then that. And I remember the first, with the point of view thing, often it's good to start a chapter with Morgan walked into the bar or whatever. And then the next chapter you're like, okay, now this is Jake. Jake did this. And then you realise that you've just started every chapter with somebody's name because it helped you write it. But then you then have to go back and change all the beginning sentences so they don't all start with a name.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, exactly. Yeah, but it really is, I think it's just impossible for are not impossible. You know, nothing's impossible. I'm sure there are people who can do it. But it's very difficult for a writer to be able to see all of that. There's so much to see in a novel. So trying to see that for yourself is just, it's really hard. So I can't do it. So...
And then you have a master's in commercial fiction, which I think's awesome. So first of all, tell us why differentiate in that way? When why did you specialize down that route?
Well, I got my undergraduate degree in literary fiction, and so I was, and actually toward my final year in school, I was starting to sort of drift toward popular fiction a little bit more, and had actually written the first draft of All the Blue-Eyed Angels, my first novel, had written it at that time. And so was really starting to get interested in mysteries. And then the graduate school that I applied to, university, or one of them, the University of Southern Maine, Dennis Lehane was teaching there at the time, and I love him. I really wanted to work with him. But you couldn't actually, new students couldn't actually work with him unless they were declared popular fiction. So that kind of made the decision for me. I was like, all right, I'm in. This is what we're going with. And but I really enjoyed it. It was actually, it was, as I said, I spent my undergrad reading literary fiction and really focusing on that. And I'm glad that I did that because it gave me a really good foundation for prose and character and all the things that you sort of are emphasized a little bit more in literary fiction. But then being able to make that transition to popular fiction where the emphasis is on plot and pacing and pulling all of those elements together was a really cool marriage, I think. It was a nice way to kind of finish out my professional or my, my education.
Yeah. No, I think it really does offer more, from, you know, in terms of I really feel like you can analyze a story a lot more. The stuff that you point out is kind of different to what I've had before. And one of the things I wondered about you was, how do you separate your creative writing mind from your editing mind? Because, you know, this is we're told by many people, just write the first draft, don't edit as you write. How does an editor who's also a writer manage that shift?
It's not easy, but when I first started writing, when I was, you know, in high school and even before that, I was a big fan of Natalie Goldberg, who wrote like Wild Mind and Writing Down the Bones and Long Quiet Highway. And she is a big advocate of the timed write, where you just sit down and you just move your pen across the paper, or you just keep typing, or however you do it. Without rereading, without stopping, you have a topic and you just write. And I still do that. That's the way that I do my first drafts. I write all of my first drafts longhand, which I know makes me a dinosaur. But I do. I can't do it any other way. So yeah, I will have a specific scene in mind that I know I need to write. I'll sit down and I will write it all out, and without stopping, without second guessing or anything like that. And then from there, I type it into the computer. So that's the only time I'll allow myself to reread it, until I'm about 25,000 to 35,000 words in. And then I'll go back and start looking at plot stuff to make sure that I'm still on the right track. But it really is, it's kind of discipline. It's just kind of saying, all right, you have to accept that it's not going to be great. That first draft isn't going to be genius. And it really is true what everybody says. You know, it's a matter of getting it on the page to begin. And then you can start working through. And that, it's no different for, certainly no different for me.
Do you write in order then? Do you write your whole book in order?
Yeah, I usually do. I usually, if I'm really stuck and the book is driving me nuts and there's a scene that I'm excited about, then I'll let myself take a day off and go back and write the scene that I'm excited about. But, and then I'll get back to the drudgery of, you know, whatever, because sometimes it is drudgery. It's, let's be honest.
Was that a little slip there? No, I agree with you. And I, you know, I'm in the first draft at the moment and it's like, oh, goodness me. And now I'm interested. Do you have like on your hand? Because I mean, I just don't write by hand anymore. Does it, do you really get bad pain in your hand or do you have like lumps and bumps on your writer's hand? I'm really interested.
I do have a callus. I have my writing callus, yeah. That I've had, but, I'm just so used to it. I have a notebook that I take with me everywhere, and I usually, especially if it's nice out, then I'll try to get outside and sit outside and write that way as much as I can, especially this time of year. But I have tried with a laptop. I've tried with, I can't do first drafts with anything other than pen to paper.
No, so. Which is brilliant because that's, I think you're the first person I've had on the show who writes longhand for the whole draft, at least. So when you edit, do you print out and edit, as in self-edit, do you print it out from the computer and edit by hand again?
No, it's all, it really is, it's just that first draft. Once the first draft is done, then I'm fine to move on to the computer. And I don't usually go back to, trying to think. Yeah, I don't usually go back to writing anything longhand after that. It really is just the process of getting that first draft out. And then from there, I do everything with track changes on the computer and stuff. So.
Oh, okay, because I do print out my first draft and edit by hand.
Oh, interesting.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So that's the reason why I write the first draft in Scrivener and then I print it out, scribble, and then put the changes back in. So,
oh, that's interesting. Yeah.
So everyone has their own little stuff.
Yeah.
Okay, so let's just come back to my editing questions, then we'll come back to your books. I wanted to, you know, a lot of people say, say I get my edits back, and what if I don't agree with the changes? Does an author have to make the changes an editor suggests?
Definitely not, unless I'm the editor, and then you should definitely do everything I say. No, I think that, the editor isn't some all-knowing entity. If there's something that you have a real problem with, or it just strikes you as this isn't quite what works for you, then, yeah, I mean, it's ultimately your novel. If there's something big and the editor is kind of pushing you toward it, then it's a good idea to, rather than just discounting that as outright wrong, It is a good idea to maybe get somebody else's opinion. So if you have a beta reader or something like that, then you can run it by them and see what they think. I know that there are certainly times when I'm working with an author and I make a suggestion and they're not crazy about it. And they sort of initially they kind of get their back up and are like, absolutely not. That's not what my character is about. I think as a writer, what you need to just be able to do is decide whether that's your ego talking or whether it really is about the book and the integrity of the novel. So, because for me, a lot of times it's ego. A lot of times it's me saying, no, you know, this is the way that I've imagined it. Ultimately, it's up to you. And so if there's something that strikes you as wrong, then, stick to your guns or talk to your editor about it. And, maintain your vision for what the novel is going to be.
Yeah, and I mean, I would say I probably make 80 to 85% of the changes that you recommend. So, but there are a few. I mean, one thing is a cultural difference. So I remember one example. I said something like the city of London. And in London, we have a city with a capital C, which is like a subset of the city with small c. And it was just that, you know, it was like, that's an example of something where it's a cultural kind of difference. And then another question on cultural differences, should an author, a self-published author, use American or British English or Australian English for that matter?
Yeah, it really depends. I think it depends, A, on the audience you're shooting for, and B, where the novel takes place, interestingly enough. I'm actually working with an Australian author right now whose book takes place in Seattle, and all of his characters are American. So to me, that it makes sense. We agreed that it would be American spelling and stuff. But I've worked with other authors whose novels take place in England, and they do prefer going with British spelling. So yeah, just look at where it takes place and who your audience, who you're targeting primarily.
I think I've generally tried for American, but I know I'm a bit of a hybrid, as in I'll still say things like torch instead of flashlight, and, you know, and lift instead of, what is it, escalator? Right, yeah. But I haven't find I don't think people really care that much. You know, some authors get so het up about this, but I think it's a procrastination issue. You know, it's like, just stop. That's not the point. You know,
if it's, exactly.
If it's a good story, no one actually cares, you know, about that type of thing.
Yeah. And I think especially now where we do live in such a global sort of setting, it's just, people accept that there are different ways to spell things and different way, you know, different words for different things, and it's not a huge deal.
Exactly. And then another question that I get a lot, which is, how do I know my writing's good enough? So people particularly who are going to self-publish. So in the old model, you would get chosen by an agent and chosen by a publishing house. In the new model, where we have to choose ourselves, how do people know that their book is good enough to publish?
That's a tough one. That's definitely a tough one. That's where beta readers really do come in handy. And because, again, this is people who are just starting out. Once you've got a book or two under your belt, then you're a little bit more obviously seasoned and know that you can do it. But initially it's having a beta reader, a couple of beta readers. It's having an editor you trust who isn't afraid to say, you know what, you're not ready to go to print just yet. It really is so much faith. It's so much just deciding, all right, you know, this is what I want, and I want it badly enough to take that risk, because every writer, regardless of how good they are, if you're a self-published author, then you're experiencing that doubt. And it's a matter of taking that leap and seeing what happens from there. But before you take the leap, beta readers, editor you trust, and go on from there.
And just do it. And if you get a really, really load of bad reviews, then you can always unpublish it and get it re-edited. Yeah.
Exactly. Worst case scenario, it's not a great novel, and you can...
Yeah, do that.
Yeah.
On that question, obviously I'm a proud indie, and, you know, this is not casting aspersions or anything, but what do you think is the state of the quality of indie work? Do you see that it's getting better, or, you know, what do you think the tsunami of crap thing is in any way true, given what you see as an editor?
I honestly think that the tsunami of crap is sort of, it kind of is, sort of, I think we're over the crap storm.
Yay!
I think that because the people who really weren't paying, who really didn't care that much and just wanted to get their novel out, I think that first influx when self-editing was so, or when self-publishing was so easy and suddenly accessible and everybody was publishing, I think now people realize that you don't become a millionaire publishing that kind of thing. And so if that's all they were in it for, because remember, like, with the whole Amanda Hawking thing and John Locke, and everybody was like, oh, my God, I can make millions this way.
Yay!
Yeah. Now the sort of reality has set in, then the people who were only in it because they had visions of grandeur or whatever have kind of fallen off. And the people who have stuck with it have realized that they really need to put out a quality novel if they're going to do anything. And so by and large, the people that I work with are, they're really committed to being better writers, and they work really hard to get there. And I have tremendous respect for the work that they put into it. I think that the quality is getting better all the time.
Yeah, I agree with you, and that's actually why it's becoming more difficult, because the people you're kind of competing with,
yeah
the quality is very high. And in fact, I'm reading a book at the moment, I won't say the author, but the editing is shocking on it, as in the it's a traditionally published book, and it's full of typos, like a lot of typos, and you know, which is annoying to me. And I think I'm less forgiving when it's traditionally published.
Mm-hmm.
You know what I mean?
Oh, yeah, I definitely am. I get very annoyed when I see a lot of, I do anyway, if there are a lot of blatant errors.
Yeah.
But especially with traditional publishing, I just feel like their thing. They're supposed to,
But I do want to ask you then, you know, because I'm writing novel number seven, and it's, you know, I'm in that saggy middle kind of crappy drudgery, as you mentioned. And it's, you know, it's really difficult. And I wonder what you think. When do you get to the point where you feel like you can tell a good story and that you're a decent enough writer? How many books does it take?
Oh my God, I don't know that it happens, does it?
I really hope it does one day.
No, I mean, I think, like, I've seen interviews with, like, Nora Roberts and stuff, where she talks about the fact that halfway through a novel, she sort of goes through that phase. So, obviously not the phase where, you know, am I
good enough,
able to do this and whatever, but I think that it gets a little bit better with every novel that you do. I don't know. It really is. It's just a matter of continuing to do it and then sort of looking at feedback and recognizing that, you know, people are in agreement that, well, I mean, in your case, people are in agreement that you're writing a really good story. And so it's starting to trust that, I think.
Yeah, I think too. I think the writer's doubt thing, the self-doubt is, the self-doubt and the ego balance. I mean, you have to have a big enough ego to want to publish anything, but then you've got this massive self-doubt that kind of overshadows you every time. I had a particularly bad case of the, oh my goodness, I'll never have another idea again, you know, earlier this year, after one day in New York. I just thought, I don't think I'll ever be able to write again. You know, it's one of those crazy moments. And then, you know, you sit down, like Natalie Goldberg says, you sit down with the blank page and you force yourself to write something, and something comes. So so let's just talk about your pentalogy. Tell us about the Erin Solomon books.
All right. So, yes, I have, it's now complete. So five books, the Erin Solomon pentalogy. And it basically tells the story of this investigative reporter who returns to her hometown to investigate an alleged cult suicide that took place when she was a child. And she witnessed, her father was actually part of the church. He survived, but so it's kind of her going back and investigating this. And then through the course of these five novels, sort of realizing that her father played a fairly big role in everything that unfolded. And a lot of it is about sort of reconciling our memories of what we perceived our what we perceived our lives to be as children and stuff with the reality of what was really there. Obviously, it's a little bit more dramatic with this, but I think it's something thrillers. That everyone kind of goes through in some way. So
yeah, and there it's thrillers, and there is high body count and explosions. I can attest to that. And lots of dogs. You love dogs, don't you?
I do love dogs. That's my next series. So working with search and rescue dogs in the next series. So I'm excited about that. But Aaron has a dog. He plays a big role in it. And he's there. And then there's romance in there, which I can't actually write something if there's not some kind of romance in there. I get
everybody
sucked
needs
in
a love
it.
Angle.
Yeah. So yeah, but it is. It's fun. It was really fun to write, and it's been really rewarding just kind of seeing that arc to its completion.
Yeah. So, and I was going to ask you about that because you managed to. Did you plan 5 novels up front, or did you just start writing and it turned into 5?
It did. Initially, like with the first novel or the first draft, it was 8 novels initially. When I finished about halfway through the final draft of the first novel, I did an outline of all 5 books, and because it is sort of serialized, I mean they're definitely interlinked. And so it was very important that I have an idea from the start where I was going with things and how the mystery was going to resolve itself and all of that. So, yeah, pretty much from the start, I knew that it was going to be multiple. And then by the time I finished the final draft of the first novel, I had complete outlines of all 5. So
how long were those outlines?
My outlining is stupid. So my outlines are like 25 pages long, and I go into excruciating detail in terms of like character development and character arc and where things are going to be and all of that stuff. I go into I usually include at least a little bit of setting research in there, and then I try to do a full breakdown. I work according to the 3-act structure. So I do a full breakdown of all 3 acts. So they're long. They're really long outlines.
Yeah, but I think, you know, I was talking about this with Ros Morris, who is on the show, and I said, you know, I think I can only hold 3 in my head. And the problem is, it's in my head. And what, you know, because I'm not a natural outliner, and I'm really trying to be, like, I would love to be. And like I'm finding with Deviance, the 3rd one in my London Psychic series, it's difficult because I didn't plan it as 3. I wrote the first one as a kind of standalone, and then wrote another one, and now with the 3rd one it's really hard because you're trying to pull together threads that were almost shut. And I'm like, goodness, this would have been so much easier if I would have planned this better. So for the next, I want to try and write something else, but I'm thinking that I would only do 3 because 3 would be easier to plot.
Oh yeah, definitely.
Yeah, and
yeah. I'll never do a pentology again.
No, it's like hardcore. And but I was going to say, I started reading. Is it Sins of the Father, the one with the upside down cross?
Southern Cross.
Southern Cross. Yeah, that one. I read that first. Mm-hmm. So I don't think it matters so much with yours if you read them out of order. You can read them out of order like any series, and you can still fill in the blanks.
Yeah.
And read them out of order. But how are you plotting the dog series, the new series?
Right now, it's because I have a prequel to the pentology that's coming out in July. And so I'm still sort of focused on tying that together at this point. But the dog series, right now I'm doing a lot of research. I've outlined, I know it takes place in northern Vermont, and I've done Yeah, I've done some rough writing, and then I have about a 20-page outline for that. And then this is going to be a series that is standalone. And so, obviously, that still means with any series, there's always going to be with character development and character arcs that continue throughout. But in terms of the actual mysteries, they'll be standalone. So that's a little bit easier, I have to say.
So that's more like my Arcane books, which are kind of episodic almost.
Yeah.
Which I think it's nice to have something that's open-ended, that, you know, you can just... Yeah, do it that way. Yeah, it's very interesting, isn't it? And the more you learn about this, the more you learn, the more you realise you have to learn.
Uh-huh. Yeah, it's endless. It really is. It's just, it's crazy how much there is to learn. So, but it's really fun. I mean, I love kind of figuring out new stuff about it and everything. So. Yeah.
It is. And I was going to ask you, do you have any books that you recommend on editing that you particularly like?
On editing, it's a good question.
I put you on the spot there.
Yeah, I use the Chicago Manual of Style in terms of for like stylistic stuff. It's funny, I really don't use, it's so sad, I don't really use books that much. There are go-to websites that I'll go to for... So, like, Grammar Girl is one that I go to a lot. And, again, Chicago Manual of Style. Oxford has a website for their editing. And, yeah, it really, at this point, is so much going to the internet. And if I have a specific question about, you know, punctuation or something like that, then I'll go to the internet to figure that out. But in terms of editing itself, I don't really use that many.
That was just a little question I had. And then I've just realised, a little follow-up question. We talked a lot. You call them beta readers. I call them beta readers. We didn't actually explain what they are. So let's just tie that up. Can you just explain them?
Yeah, sure. Beta, whatever you want to call them, readers are essentially readers that when you have a completed draft of your novel that you feel like you've reached a point where you can't really make any more changes knowledgeably, but you don't think you're ready for an editor yet, then beta readers are, sometimes they're professionals. I do it professionally myself, and I know there are other people who offer it as a service, or there are a lot of fellow writers out there who will do it for you in exchange for a beta read of their novel. And they go through and they don't do editing, but they'll look at the big picture of your novel. They'll make sure that the plot, they'll tell you if the plot works, if the characters make sense, if there are big holes in sort of what you've set, then they'll let you know those big picture things that is really important when you're first getting a novel completed. Mm-hmm. That's where they come into play.
And really important to only use beta readers who like your genre. So I wouldn't give mine to romance readers, for example.
Yes. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that's really key.
Yeah, super important. All right, Jen, where can people find you and your books and your editing services online?
For my author stuff, I'm at jenblood.com. My editing stuff is adianediting.com. And then I'm on Twitter at Jen Blood, and I'm on Facebook and all of those places. And then my books are on, they're everywhere. They're on Amazon and the iStore and Kobo and Nook. And then you can get the print through Amazon and Barnes & Noble, I believe, or through the website.
Oh, so. And of course, there's a question I also forgot. Is Jen Blood your real name?
Yes, it really is.
It's like pen, isn't it? It's pen and blood together. We're pretty good.
Yeah, exactly.
Brilliant. Well, thanks for your time, Jen. That was great.
Excellent. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening today. I hope you found it helpful. You might also like the backlist episodes at thecreativepen.com/podcasts. You can also get your free Author 2.0 blueprint at thecreativepen.com/blueprint. If you'd like to connect, you can tweet me at The Creative Pen or find me on Facebook at The Creative Pen. See you next time!